You're listening to the Fusion Patrol Podcast.
Hello. Welcome to another episode of Fusion Patrol. I'm Eugene.
I'm Ben.
And tonight we're going to be looking at the latest Doctor Who episode, Night Terrors by Mark Gatiss. Well, I like this episode. I'm just going to come right out on the front. I thought this was the best episode this entire half season. By far. So far.
I would agree.
And one of the better ones of the whole season six.
Mm-hmm.
But let's talk about the episode first, then we'll tell you why it's so wonderful.
I can give you two reasons why. I can sum up why it was wonderful in two words.
Two words?
Yes. Mark Gatiss.
Hmm. All right. Well, he did write it, and he was not in it. Although, if you look at his Twitter avatar lately, you could say he does look a bit like one of those wooden dolly things.
Creepy.
Yeah. Well, anyway, the story begins with a little boy in his room with his sort of poor family, and he's scared of this, and he's scared of that, and he's terrified of all this stuff. And his mind projects a help across galaxies and space and time, and it arrives on the psychic paper in the doctor's pocket, and the doctor... Hold on. And the doctor takes the TARDIS back to Earth in what appears to be, I guess, fully current day to solve the problem, which is that this little boy is afraid of the monsters. So what stands out in this episode for you?
Well, one of the things that I liked about it is... Mark Gatiss really was able to play on a lot of those childhood fears. I mean, we see this little boy, Georgie.
Mm-hmm.
He has his torch, or flashlight as we call it. And here he's looking at all the objects. I mean, he sees shadows, and he sees menacing things in the shadows. And he really captured, I think, something that a lot of children go through. I know I did. I would see, my imagination will make up all sorts of really strange objects that were in my bedroom when I was a child. And he really was able to play on that, not just the images in the room, but the strange noises. I mean, like, the elevator makes this terrible grinding noise, and then there's this neighborhood lady who breathes really hard and sounds rather inhuman. So he was able to really play on... I think Mark Gatiss did a great job at showing all the childhood nighttime terrors that we used to have. I would imagine he probably had them too, because they were captured really well. And that was one of the first things that just leapt right out to me.
Yes, it's a creepy episode. It's a good, scary episode, but I will say that it did not, as far as I can tell, cause my children any problem, you know, in the fear factor point of view. They're 6 and 9. And
well, it wasn't a scary episode.
I could see how you could think it was scary, though. I mean,
there were some creepy moments. There were some interesting things they did in the episode, which I thought, oh, well, that's a chilling little touch right there.
But so, you know, you as you say, the boy captured the feel, the writer captured the feel. The boy did a very good job of conveying it.
He was a great little actor.
Of, you know, the things in your room that when it's dark become sinister and whatnot. So, and then you're shown an episode where indeed they do come real, which is the fear. So yes, I could see how a child would then take that with them to bed in their own room.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if they weren't already predisposed, well, particularly if they were already predisposed to that sort of thing. I mean, I used to have to, you know, I don't know when I quit it, but I remember they used to have to close the closet door because there were clothes hung up in it, and mm-hmm. in the dark they looked like it might be a person back there,
mm-hmm.
and check under the bed. And then I, one point they had this painting, well, it was a print, obviously, of famous painting. I can't think of who it's by, but Blue Boy is the, I hated that painting. Oh, I hated that. That used to occasionally stick its tongue out at me at night. I mean, you know, when you get in the dark and the mind is running wild, that sort of stuff happens. And so, yeah, I'm frankly surprised we didn't get a wake up in the middle of the night from the kids over that one. But we didn't, which is kind of interesting. In the story, the Doctor and Amy get separated. Well, and Rory, too. He's stuck with Amy. They go down the elevator, and then suddenly it collapses, and they arrive in this place. Which is
how long did it take you to figure out what it was?
I figured out what it was as soon as they flashed an image of the thing. Well, I mean, there's potential for spoilers here. I mean, it's that they're in a dollhouse. When I saw the dollhouse in the cupboard.
Ooh, I figured it out. Well, I'm not. If memory serves, I could be wrong. But I think I figured it out before we even saw that the dollhouse was in the cupboard.
I did not. But there are a couple things I'll admit that I didn't see. Coming.
Amy picking up the copper pan or whatever that was, and just made of wood. And I went, dollhouse. Yeah. I was rather proud of myself for that.
You know, I don't know whether they did that well or not. I didn't really pay attention. I mean, in a dollhouse, do all doors open? Do cabinets open? They don't usually, do they? So.
It depends on the complexity of the dollhouse.
So here's my question for you. So basically, you know, these are the kids' toys that they've been put into. So here's my question. Do we really think that this boy would have, and maybe I'm misreading gender roles these days, but would he really have had a dollhouse and dolls like that? I mean, I can understand, you know, yeah, okay, you can let a boy play with dolls, but that was really quite an elaborate girl's doll set that he had in there. And I, you know, yeah, okay, it's creepy, but he didn't have a sister around the house or anything to justify it, so it was kind of, it's like,
It is questionable, yeah.
But, anyway. Well, Amy,
it didn't take away from my enjoyment.
No, that's the whole point. There were things about this story that I should have caught that I didn't, and it's a credit to the writing, like the fact that when the boy projected the psychic paper, I took that as, I mean, obviously not science fact, because this is really a fantasy program, but I took that as read. It's like, ooh, a really scared boy apparently can beam a signal across.
I did the same thing. I thought his emotions were so intense that he was literally able to project a message.
But it made a whole lot more sense when they got to the end, and it turns out...
When we finally find out who he really is, then it makes tons of sense. But again, you're right. It was so well written that I was able to accept the idea that this little boy is in such terror that he could project this message and that it would show up on the doctor's psychic paper. I mean, I had no problem buying it.
Yeah. Very good lines in the episode. I like Amy and Rory's conclusion. It's like, are we dead again?
I like him. He says, "Was I?" Yep. Okay. Great.
Yeah.
Great. Yeah. The lines. There was some very good dialogue. Even the doctor. I mean, you know, and you and I have complained about how many times we thought the doctor was just been a little bit too madcap. And while he did come across again as just being kind of loony, he did come off better, and I think a lot of it were the lines that he was given.
You know, here's the thing. In this episode, because there was a kid in the episode, I feel like, and I could be completely wrong, but I feel like the doctor is relating to the child and trying to convey something to a child. So his zany behavior is a cunning ploy.
Yeah, it's more for the child's benefit.
As opposed to when I see it in like, for example, Let's Kill Hitler or a variety of other stories, they're just playing it to be goofy. And
right.
I don't like that. I didn't like it when Tom Baker was off the depths of his goofy end. But he was never that far off the depths of the goofy end. But, you know, most of the time Tom Baker played it, that there was a glint of steel behind that clownish activity.
Mm-hmm.
It was a little bit different with Troughton because he was not... He was not a man of action. There was, but yet again, there was a glint of extreme intelligence back there.
Yeah,
that was that. You know, it didn't come off as goofy. It came off as I'm faking goofy. And Matt Smith is.
I don't get that from him.
I don't get that from him. I get goofy most
I
of the
too.
Time.
But although
in
I
this
agree
episode,
with you. Yeah, I agree with you. I think in this one, it felt the same way to me too. That when he was being nutty. That he was doing it for the kid's benefit.
Or to reassure the dad, or to...
Yeah, but there was a deliberate reason behind it. It wasn't just, I'm nuts because I'm nuts.
Yeah. So, I think there's definitely a split with the way the writers are going on this, and I'd hope they'll... I hope they rein it back into
Well, I'd like to
level.
See more of what... I mean, obviously, you don't want to see Matt... Smith constantly having to relate to a child, but in terms of there's a reason for the nuttiness, and we kind of get a hint of that. Yeah, I'd like to see that kind of behavior more often.
Awful lot of children in New Who, though. I mean, in Moffat Who. I mean, we've got the dyslexic boy from the Silurians. We've got Amy, of course, as a child. We had the boy in the pirate story. I mean, there's an awful lot of
Kids.
The Christmas Carol, they really mm-hmm. do tend to try to bring that in. And that's very difficult to do, because, you've heard the mantra, no cute kids
no
robots
kids.
Ever.
Yeah.
You put a kid in a show, and it's very difficult to portray them realistically. It's difficult to put them in the plot in a way that they aren't in the way.
I felt they've done for the most part a good job.
They have done a good job. I think I don't think that they've really thrown a misstep. The only one that's felt weird to me was the boy in the Silurian, and not because he was a problem. It's just that they had that whole subplot of him being dyslexic. I was about to say anorexic. He was being dyslexic, and that didn't seem to have any.
It had no
bearing on the story of any kind, but back to this one. Ultimately, we had, you know, the doctor investigating a mystery, which was what was going on in the cupboard in the boy's room, which was reading off the scale of danger with the sonic screwdriver, and of course, inside the dollhouse, the creepy dolls are chasing people and turning them into dolls.
Might I add, that was a creepy effect, the way they did it. It was kind of done in a stop-motion sort of style, which I, for some reason, it just really made that...
Reminded me of American Werewolf in London.
Yeah, it had a horror.
Had that sort of, you know, like the arms stretching out and stiffening up and cracking like wood.
Right. I mean, they could have easily done it with some sort of CGI. I mean,
they may have.
Effects technology. Well, they probably did. But they could have made it looking really slick. And instead, they chose to have it look a little primitive. And I think that added to the overall atmosphere of the episode, especially the transformations. We first see it happen with the landlord. We then later see Amy turn into a doll, and in both cases, it's kind of creepy.
Yeah.
I mean, I hate to keep throwing that word out, but that's exactly what it was.
Well, I wouldn't want it to happen to me.
No, but the way they did it was very rather chilling. You know, visually speaking.
All thing on. I mean, I give full marks to the episode. I thought it was. I really there was very little to.
I find
very little to complain with.
Yeah, very little to criticize with this.
I am so happy that it had nothing to do with the story arc, which is just ruining the rest of the series.
I was almost afraid of it when the doctor is talking to Georgie's father, and all of a sudden he finds out, well, he and the wife couldn't have kids. And the whole thing is, how come I couldn't remember that? And I thought, oh, no. Are we going to get one of these more, why don't I remember that? You know, it immediately thought of the silence. I couldn't help it. But then, you know, the doctor comes back and says, oh, it's just a perception filter. And then he gives
and it's a perception filter.
Right. It's a perception filter. And he explains it in a rather fast, almost frenetic sort of way, which that would be my one and only criticism, and that they kind of breeze through that portion of the explanation just a little too fast. Thank God I had the subtitles on, because I would not have understood a single word Matt Smith was saying.
Well, those British people, they do speak awful fast for us poor Americans.
Yeah, well, he's got that down to an art. But that would be the only criticism that I would have. You know, once they did explain, oh, no, it's a perception filter, it's because of who George really is, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I'm like, oh, okay, I'm good. I can move on now.
This one will go down there with Mark Gatiss's other scripts. The one with the dead people, and the one with the TV people, and the other one that he did.
Wow.
Yeah, I know. That was terrible. I mean, I do know which ones they are. So he did the Unquiet Dead and the...
I liked the Unquiet Dead. I thought
that was
good. The
Unquiet Dead was pretty good, yes. I thought that was pretty good. And the Idiot's Lantern. And I really can't remember the other one that he did. Or did he? Maybe he didn't get one. Oh, anyway, it doesn't really matter.
I can't remember.
I'm going to be embarrassed when I figure out that he did have another one. But
I honestly can't remember at this point. I mean, I just keep jumping back to his participation in Sherlock and obviously First Man on the Moon, and that's it.
Yeah. And of course, I mean, his Bravo performance as a young vet, country vet in League of Gentlemen. But no? You're not familiar with that one?
I honestly didn't catch that.
Oh, you should.
Was he in League of Extraordinary Gentlemen?
Yes. Not Extraordinary Gentlemen. That's the movie with Sean Connery.
Right. That's the only one. But
League of Gentlemen is the town of Royston Vasey for local
never
people.
Saw it. Never saw
oh,
it.
Oh, you've never seen that. Oh, you have to watch that. But I will find you a YouTube clip where he is doing basically a Peter Davison imitation as the vet. In this
He's doing his own little send-up of all creatures great and small, huh?
It's a weird show to begin with, but anyway. I don't know that there's anything else to point out on this episode.
One of the things that I didn't expect yet appreciated, it had, and some people might think it's a little too much, but I thought it had a very touching ending where we find out that a lot of this really stems from Georgie believing that he's going to be rejected. That's really the fear, that he's going to – that he's not really wanted by his parents, especially by his father, or and I guess in this case we can go ahead and say that his adopted father.
Mm-hmm.
And that final statement of acceptance – it was a very powerful moment. I mean, in the midst of this, what is a very scary moment for Georgie and a very potentially life-threatening moment for our heroes, to all of a sudden turn it around and have the father just pick up George and let him know how much he loves him, and for Georgie to start crying and then and tell his father how much he loves him. It it in any other scene, in any other setting, it might have come across as just too much. But in this particular episode, it was the perfect counterbalance to this intense moment of, oh my God, we're all going to die. And it really, I found it to be a rather nice way to kind of end that. I'm sure that other people will completely disagree with me, but I think that's just a question of personal taste.
It might have been a little too fast.
I don't know. They were running out of time.
I think
maybe there might have been a little bit. They could have started the resolution just a little bit sooner, possibly.
Yeah.
But again, that's a very subjective statement.
One of the things that I don't necessarily like about New Who at all, predominantly because of the length of time, and you know we've attributed this flaw to Russell T. Davies, and it's not entirely his fault. It is the fault of 45 minutes of TV. Is that in earlier Doctor Who's? In fact, I was watching Deadly Assassin with Tom Baker earlier today with the kids, and it kind of struck me that the Doctor was solving the problem throughout the much of the story. But he was putting pieces...
He was on the path.
He was getting things done. And too often in the New Who, we're just kind of wandering around, seeing things happening, and we're not getting the clues.
I get the sense that he's really reacting for two-thirds of the episode, and then in the final third, he actually steps up to the plate and then starts taking action. While in more classic Who, in fact, the other night, we actually watched, and this is not from their more shining moment of Tom Baker series, but just for laughs.
Horns of Nyman?
No, we watched The Creature of the Pit.
Oh, I love The Creature from the Pit.
And when he's
talking into that protuberance.
Yeah. Yeah, okay, yeah. I'm sure you can't exactly have... Well, he did more than just talk into it at one point. But I'm sure that, yeah, you wouldn't have that kind of thing done today. But Keith made the point, as we were watching it, essentially the mystery had been solved at the end of part three, and yet now we've got this. Now we have this part four, and maybe the writer had to come up with all this new drama to try and wrap it up. It's just a little thing we noticed, but we did see the Doctor at least taking steps to understand what was going on right from the very start. And you could say that Matt Smith's Doctor was doing that in this episode. I mean, first from trying, going to the house, meeting Georgie, talking to him. Although I think there was a lot of wasted time with them knocking on doors.
But don't you think, yeah, there was, but don't you think that the Doctor, I mean, let's face it, the Doctor went to the boy's house entirely on the assumption that it was just scared of the dark. Because it wasn't until the Doctor, you know, casually screwdrivered the cupboard just to show him.
And saw this nasty energy reading, which, it freaked him out. Even.
So he was really just kind of doing what a parent would do when the child is terrified at night. Sit there on the bed and try to reassure them and try a different approach to make them happy and get them past that thing. So he really wasn't looking into a monster mystery. And then
he discovered there really was one.
Then he really discovered there was one, and it was... And the other thing, of course, the Doctor is the greatest, smartest being in the universe. We've been told that over and over again. I don't actually like the Doctor being the smartest creature in existence. But that does also somewhat take away from the storytelling, because he knows everything, and so it's just really a question of getting enough data into his head that he can then suddenly recall everything he needs to know about the creature, the alien, whatever it is, as opposed to in the earlier Doctor Who's where he would
spend time. There was an actual mystery that he had to learn.
That he had to learn and had to understand. And so we as the audience could go along with the process, whereas we can't now. The process happens inside the Doctor's head. And 11th Hour, they tried to show that with that whole sequence where the Doctor was replaying everything he'd seen. And, you know, Rory taking the picture of the wrong direction and all that stuff. But really, it's just, you know, it's just stuff going on outside of our awareness. And I think that diminishes. I think that diminishes the story.
It does take away a little bit that I. But again, I kind of got the feeling that the Doctor was, and maybe you're right. Maybe that's exactly what was going on here. But I didn't get that sense. I got the feeling that once the Doctor realized that there was this incredibly dangerous reading that he was getting from inside the cupboard, at this point he had himself a mystery.
Okay, but I'll give you an example. There's something I'm missing. Snap, 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 snap. There's something I'm missing. Something I've seen. Something in this room. Something. That makes this whole thing make sense of it. And, well, we were never shown it. So there's no chance that the audience is ever going to figure out that he saw a picture in the photo album that showed on Christmas Eve she wasn't pregnant, and on New Year's she'd had a baby.
Yeah.
And so we're not even given that information. We're just told that the Doctor has got it in his head, and he's just, I can't quite juggle it all together yet. Again, we're not participants in solving what's going on. We are purely spectators as the audience.
Yeah, that's true. With other episodes, I would have said, well, again, the series has been sort of redesigned to be not so much about the Doctor, but to be about the companions. However, in this particular episode, that's really not the case.
Yeah.
It really wasn't so much about the companions. It really was about the Doctor. So, yeah, there's that little bit of incongruity there.
Well, so we think it's a good episode.
Yes. Very, very enjoyable.
And I think it's a better episode than Let's Kill Hitler.
I think it's an infinitely better episode than Let's Kill Hitler. And luckily, all my friends, both here and across the pond, feel the same way.
Argument from, what is it? Argument from populism, something like that. Well, everybody else likes it, so it must be good.
Well, obviously that doesn't hold any water because Let's Kill Hitler was enormously popular on both sides of the pond, and just a very small minority of us
see it for
really
what it
disliked
is.
It.
Well, I think we're going to have a couple more episodes coming up here pretty soon. Next week is The Girl Who Waited on Doctor Who.
I'm very curious about that one.
Yes, and we've got an episode of Star Lost that we're just itching to watch and review for you.
Dear Lord.
So we hope you'll join us again next time on Fusion Patrol.
End of line.
You've been listening to the Fusion Patrol podcast, a production of Lone Locust Productions. Join us on our new discussion forums at FusionPatrol.com. Find us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Username Fusion Patrol. You can also send us feedback by email at feedback@fusionpatrol.com. If you'd like to support Fusion Patrol, please leave us a review on iTunes. Fusion Patrol's theme music is Fight the Future by Amberwolf.